Campus FM presents a public discussion on European issues with Professor Jonathan Story, organized by the European Movement.
Welcome, Professor Story, after that bumpy ride from Paris. We are glad you made it, and many of those who were invited have stayed here. Some have had to leave because of other engagements, but nevertheless, you know, we let's begin without much more ado. Professor Story, please.
Thank you very much for staying on. I'm delighted to be here. I'm sorry I came late. But nonetheless, here we all are. I'll just say a few things about myself. My wife Heidi is here. She's still married to me, nearly 40 years on. Which is a great accomplishment. I've at INSEAD, business school in Fontainebleau, and I've been there. We've been there since 1974. We brought up our children in Fontainebleau. Our eldest boy is a computer engineer with Sun Systems. Our daughter has just got a baby boy 2 months ago, and which is also good news. And she's married to a laser physicist who did his doctorate in Imperial College. They're in Switzerland for the moment. Then I have a third boy who's making films. We made some films in Brazil on the impact of China on Brazil for CNN and CNBC earlier this year. And finally, my younger son, Alex, is in London working with Dow Jones, and he also is married, and a baby is on the way. So things are going the right direction for us. The subject is, as you know, Europe after the nor and the nay, but I've given it a different angle because I'm sure that as members of the, or followers of the European movement, you have heard lots about the ins and outs of the politics of the nor and the nay. I want to put this in the more global context, because actually I think that's the one it should be. So hence the title, which I have here, Europe and Globalization, Opportunity or Threat. If you wish, we can distribute this slideshow after in PDF format to you. There've always been, I'm going to start out very simply saying the two different views of Europe, which you know very well, and then I'm going to comment on the different interpretations of Europe and how they fit with some of the real conditions that people live in their everyday life. There've been always two broad visions of Europe. The first one is, if you like, you can summarize it, there are many different versions of it. Europe is becoming United States of Europe. The word there is becoming, it isn't yet. Its natural direction is to become a federal state of some form or other. And this, of course, has two key dimensions. One is market integration. Those are integration, particularly, is a sort of heavy word. But it really would mean that the whole of Europe, from Finland right through to Malta, and from Poland right through to, or Ukraine right through to Portugal, eventually would be like an internal market. So that suppliers and customers in any part of Europe could always be assured of supplies and of service in any other part. There would be no suspicions which is rather typical of a national or sovereign states, that they have to preserve some part of their business because they can't quite trust the others. There would be, if you like, complete trust in the source of supply, and therefore, if you like, linked with that would be the rule of law, of one law, overriding state laws in the whole of the European Union. Now, this idea has always been there since 1948, when the Hague Conference was called. It was presided over by Churchill, and the discussions at that time were very clearly between those who wanted a Europe of united Europe, of a federal Europe, and those like Churchill, actually, who were much more concerned with the second view, which is, if you like, Europe is an inherited reality. And that inherited reality is very complex. It expresses itself nowadays as a mosaic of states, of interdependent states, with very different religious and cultural backgrounds, and different laws and different details which make the warp and the woof of Europe. And within that, of course, there are the smaller and the bigger powers. These two views have always been present throughout the European history of the last 50 years, and none of them have won out, ever. None of them won out, really, in the Maastricht Treaty, which is a crucial treaty, probably the most important treaty, I would argue, since the Rome Treaty. And they definitely didn't win out in the constitutional treaty. It was neither one nor the other. It was a constitutional, in other words, something moving towards a Europe of a United States of Europe, but it was a constitutional treaty between states. And this was one of the problems of selling it. Was it a constitution or was it just a treaty? I remember, like many other people, no doubt, talking to a taxi chauffeur in Paris, and the lady said, well, I read this thing, and I looked at Article 3, and then I was told to go and refer to Article 21 and Article 631, subparagraph X. It was so complex that I thought, if these people can't actually make a clear constitution like we have in France, or in the United States, then this is because lawyers are trying to make an amount of money on it. So she voted against because she couldn't understand it. The question is, which Europes mix in people's minds? These two Europes, which one? How do they mix? So I want to come back to two key French ideas that underpin this, if you like. Both of these gentlemen, Jean Monnet and Charles de Gaulle, will be very well known to you. After the war, it was France which was in the driving seat, because Germany was reacquiring sovereignty and was not really eager to push forward its own views. But actually, German policy was important. The initiative, nonetheless, clearly remained with the French. And this historical perspective, I think, is worth remembering. Here is Jean Monnet, who writes the tragic events. Jean Monnet was always considered to be one of the key founders of the European. The tragic events we have lived through have perhaps made us wiser, but men pass on and others take their place. We will not be able to hand on our personal experience. It will die with us. What we can hand on are institutions. This is a crucial point. You can't rely on individuals. This idea has run right through the whole of the European effort. In fact, it was crucial in the negotiations on Maastricht, because one of the ideas behind of Kohl, of Chancellor Kohl, and of President Mitterrand, is that they were the last generation of politicians in Europe who would have experienced the war, and that unless they pushed through a single currency and a single central bank, which was the opportunity they had at the time, another generation may not quite remember the disasters, so they would perhaps not be so keen. This idea of institutions as living beyond the life of a single person is central to the whole European episode, and it's a very, very important one, because I will just state my position immediately on this. The value of institutions is not necessarily that there's an awful lot of complex policies. They definitely do that in Europe, but it is because they socialize local politicians into becoming more European. Unfortunately, they do it rather late, because local politicians, if you want to get up in your politics in France, Germany, Denmark, Malta, Italy, you have to be all the time here. You can't be traveling around. So, unfortunately, you tend to get European experience when you're 40s or 50s, often when it's a little bit too late for you to learn. This is the great power idea of Europe, organized by the major powers, and in this case, the key alliance being France and Germany. Here you have the two very different versions. Let's try to synthesize these and say, what are the different underlying accounts of how Europe is, based on those two principles? The first one is, as I've said, Europe is a mosaic of states. Let's put it on the other side. Europe is heading towards market integration. In other words, states and markets, and here, law and power. I would argue those are the sort of key features of the European environment. Let's go around each one of these quadrants and fill them in with the different views of Europe. This is the constitutional treaty, if you like, position. We are promoting greater integration, and we are anticipating the rule of law. So EU institutions in the constitutional treaty were considerably strengthened. Majority voting was enlarged. One of the rationales of the constitutional treaty was to adapt and integrate the 10 members, new members, from Eastern Europe and the Mediterranean. It would also be, of course, to complete the internal market. There's many areas of the internal market which have not been completed, for instance, in services and many other areas in procurement. One underlying idea here would be, of course, to develop the social dimension of so that we don't just create a single market, but we also create a viable net for people in unfortunate circumstances, old age, young children, and so on, to be protected against the vicissitudes of modern economic life. Considerable progress was made in the constitutional treaty on creating a common foreign defense policy. UK, France were behind that, but there was also the idea of having a common foreign ministry, a foreign minister, as it were, and a president. It included the goal of Lisbon, which is to make Europe into one of the more, or the most competitive area in the world. And above all, the idea is that Europe would speak with one voice, through the president, whoever that would be. Now, of course, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing has written, would definitely see himself as a candidate for that position since he wrote the Constitution. But this would be really the Europe of the rule of law and Europe of integration. Let's put down here Europe of mosaic, where the rule of powers prevail. This is a very much more competitive Europe, competitive between states, and where actually power rather than law prevails. A competition among peoples and governments over the nature and details of policy, with a spread of nationalism and differentiation between the Europeans. A sense that if someone wins something, then they take everything. And of course, an idea that the motivation of people is actually to get as much out of it and to put as much out of it as possible and put as much in as little as possible. In this world of competition, cultures are challenged, for instance, by the domination of English language. The French language used to be preeminent in the Brussels environment. It's now clearly not. A selection of the fittest. This would be the rendering, for instance, in Germany of Mr. Montefering, the social democratic candidate to replace Mr. Schröder, really, who talked about locusts coming in, the investment banks coming in and gobbling up German Mittelstandfirmen. And above all, very important, an extra-European battle of the systems. In other words, you have the Anglo-Saxon so-called liberal market economy against the social system of France and Germany and so on. Competition prevails here. Cooperation, it was hoped, would prevail here. In fact, actually, this was defeated in France by the majority view of people who had conceived of Europe as down here, both on the left and on the right. Let's look at this one here, a Franco-German tandem. In other words, where the powers rule, but there's a degree of integration, particularly on market factors. The leadership would be the French and German system. Now, this is clearly what Mr. Schröder, the German, German leadership, has in mind. It's definitely what the French leadership has in mind. And it is supported by Belgium. Germany gets more voting rights than any other state because its GNP and population together give it greater weight. The continental model is what is to be exported to the rest of Europe, so one can have a level playing field without competition downwards on social standards or on norms that have been established in the key states. It would be a sort of federal state of Europe, but where the states themselves in the Council of Ministers were really in the power and really deciding the agenda. The Commission would really be taking its orders from them. And of course, this would be a world where Europe would be capable of projecting its power, to use great power terminology, into the Middle East, into the Balkans, having its, from the French perspective, and since 2002, the Iraq War, against the Anglo-Saxons. Unfortunately, the word of the Anglo-Saxons seems to include the Irish, which is not very accurate, but still. And up here, you get the rule of law and Europe's mosaic. Now, this is the Europe that I think actually is the subtle Europe. It's one bed and 25 dreams. The Chinese say, you know, you should always be careful which bed you sleep in, because you might have one bed and two dreams, etc. But in Europe, I would argue that the real description of Europe is one bed, 25 dreams. And this gets very much more interesting, because we have an EU language, let's say the Finnish, use the EU language of integration, the French use the EU language of integration, but actually what they're talking about is their local agenda, because they don't want to speak too loud about it. It's an EU which is really owned by its locals. In other words, policy is settled first, not in Brussels, but in Paris, in Berlin, in London, in Helsinki, in Copenhagen. That's where Europe is actually settled. Consensus, of course, is the key, because no government can really be overruled if it insists. There are therefore multiple external ties of Europe. The Finnish, for instance, have Nokia. Nokia is 80% of the Helsinki Stock Exchange. When I was writing a book on China, people said, that country, Nokia, in the north of Europe, is very interesting. It has its external dimensions. Of course, Portugal has its external dimensions in Angola, Mozambique, and Brazil, Spain in Latin America, the UK, and everywhere people play cricket. Africa and West, France in West Africa, and so on. Multiple external ties, and the key concept which triumphs within is the idea of mutual recognition, which was actually the idea that was inserted at the heart of the internal market in 1985-86. Mutual recognition is a very simple concept, a very, very important one. It says we recognize we do things differently, but doing things differently is no longer an excuse for protection. It's about as simple as that. Therefore, it has very important consequences. Therefore, standards, norms, taxes come into competition with each other. Now, of course, that concept was not really accepted by a Franco-German Europe view, where the continental model had to be preserved against competition. And finally, of course, in this Europe, Europe does have many voices because it can't have one. Since the Finns have a distinct voice, the Irish have a distinct voice, everybody has a distinct voice, and in most cases on world affairs, the Europeans will not speak with one voice. They'll speak with many voices, but they will speak. Now, the question is, which Europe has come out top after the norm and A? Which is prevailing, the constitutional treaty and EU enlargement? I just want to go through one or two features of this view and to point out, if you like, that it's run into big troubles because the constitutional treaty and EU enlargement have really underlined some very important factors. The most important one is enlargement to 25 magnifies the diversity in the external relations of Europe. It's very difficult to keep a constitutional treaty, enlargement, rule of law, where everybody's towing the same line, in a Europe where there's so much diversity. So let's look at this. And I've got up here some indications of the old Europe of 15 and a population, and the applicant Europe prior to entry last year. Over here is the GDP. So you can see the old Europe is very wealthy, and in fact, actually, the new Europe has, that is, the whole of Eastern Europe and the Mediterranean, Cyprus and yourselves, has an economy the size of southern Italy. Now, if I'm thinking, why did it take 10 years from the time when Gorbachev and Bush met in Malta, announcing the end of the Cold War, if you like, or 10 to 15 years? Why did it take 15 years for the end of the Cold War to actually overcome Yalta, from Malta to Yalta? Why did it take so long? And the answer is actually, that the European Union is not just about ideals, it's frankly about very small interests. And here I have the one indication, the most important one of which is that the farm population of Western Europe is about 3%, but it absorbs 80% of the new budget for 2006 to 2013. And the Polish population has 30% of its population in agriculture, and it will absorb a fraction. The reason for the delay is quite simply greed in Western Europe. It's as simple as that. It was steel industries in Galicia, in Spain, or special interests in textiles or special interests in agriculture, in Scottish strawberries, for instance, which imposed quotas and tariffs on Eastern Europe. Now, given the fact that the Eastern Europeans in particular rediscovered liberty and thought that Europe was about liberty, when they realized it was about discussing details of very modest contributions to their agriculture, enthusiasm for the European ideal tended to decline in Central Eastern Europe. It was, I would argue, the undermining of the constitutional treaty was actually the pathetic leadership of the Western European major states and their failure to grasp the major moment of 1990 and to say, we will open to free markets. They couldn't do that. So they stored up an awful lot of resentments, and that has come through, of course, in their own heartlands as well. Here is some indication of popularity of the EU project. From 1980, it took a big upward leap right through to 1990. These are figures from Eurobarometer. Were upward of about 70%. And as soon as Germany united and things began to become more problematic, support has fallen sometimes to below 50%, 55 to again below. Let's look at it in particular here because this is important. These are the bigger states, and the further we go down, this is of course the UK, which is the least enthusiastic of the European Union from the constitutional treaty, but this is Germany and this is France. In other words, over time, popular support for the whole constitutional treaty approach began to wane away. So there was not real enthusiastic support for this first vision. Let's look at the second one, competition. And here I want to make the point that the Eastern Europeans went through a major transition and recovered very well. I'm just going to show you growth rates of different countries. This is Bulgaria. Of course, Bulgaria collapsed because its Soviet economy was producing things that weren't needed, and then has had a strong revival, as you can see, in differentiated way by most of all the other states. That's Poland, which has done very well because of inward direct investment, Hungary as well, and Czech lands. But what they have done is to acquire, as I'll show you in my next slide, a considerable competitive advantage against the Western Europeans in terms of wage differentials. Luxembourg is the richest, very small city in Europe. Please note Ireland. Very, very important country. Ireland, when it joined in 1973, was the poorest country in the European Union. It's now, frankly, the richest, because Luxembourg is really just a city. And, of course, the gap is very large. If you go right down to Latvia, Poland, Malta is here. There's a huge income gaps which have developed as Europe has acquired its geographic size. It's worth noting that Germany's average unit labour costs are below Italy. So many people in Western Europe think that Eastern Europeans are taking unfair advantage. And this is one very important argument in the debates in France over this constitutional treaty, that the constitutional treaty could do nothing to stop French or multinational corporations delocating from France because of high cost to lower cost production in Eastern Europe. And you can see here on these figures the very considerable gap between hourly labor costs in the Europe of the 15, about $22 per hour in 2002, down to Slovakia's 3. Of course, if I threw in China, it would be down to 0.60 on average, and down to 0.10 if I went to the backwoods of China. And since we're dealing in a global market, of course, this concern about very differentiated labor costs in a single market has also been a factor of undermining some people's concerns. So let's look at the third one, which is prevailing. This is an Anglo-Saxon view of the 1990 relationship between France and Germany. It's a dog which looked very much like a Prussian soldier, with a French tail on the end. In fact, actually, this was a very important motivation. This idea was a very, very important motivation in Mrs. Thatcher's opposition to German unification, or desire to slow it down. I've argued in things I've written that this is a very fallacious argument. It was actually France that won German unification. It's a very, very important point. I have argued that the creation of the single currency and the abolition of the Deutschmark was France's greatest diplomatic victory since the 17th century. And I think that's definitely true. France basically said, you must hand over the Deutschmark because you, in Germany, must not ever rule Europe. And Kohl was the only person who agreed. German business wasn't agreed, the German Bundesbank was not agreed, German business was very reticent. And in any case, this was the view of the time, and many people represented that Germany would now be the great booming country post-unification. In fact, actually, that has not been the case. One of the ways we can trace this through is seeing how Germany's corporate industrial labor market structures have changed. And here I'm going to make a comparison between corporate governance systems, banking, financial, and so on, in Germany. I put the major dates of the German legislation right through to the 1986 period. Here is a typical example of German, Austrian, Swiss, in different ways, Dutch, Swedish corporate systems. In Germany in particular, many local banks, many local exchanges, now centralized in Frankfurt, characterized by cross-shareholding corporations which own each other and own each other's shares, share each other's boards. In Germany, there's always after the war, and this is still very much a view that is that legitimates business in Germany, corporate managers at the end of the year hand out profits and give money to the shareholders last. Shareholders last. Who comes first? Well, investment in training, particularly through apprenticeships and Meisterprüfung, all of which is very excellent in Germany. investment in people, investment in maintaining a loyal workforce and so on, and investment in R&D and research and development. In this environment, very few hostile takeovers occur. I mean by that, if a company's shares fall, it's bought up by a predator who then divides it up and sells it off at a profit into different hands, and workers, managers lose their jobs. In this German tradition, companies have normally been too big to fail. They're too big to fail. So they're bailed out. And since they carry heavy costs because they're too big to fail, or they're carrying heavy R&D investments and very rich in skill sets, then they go for market share, they go for sales with very low profits. The result of that has been typically Germany and Japan, following systems like this, run trade surpluses. It's very difficult to export into Germany. It's a very powerful exporting machine. And consequently, as the Deutschmark or the Yen rose, so foreign direct investment went abroad. Let me look at the Anglo-American perspective, which is very, very different, very different legislative backgrounds. I'm making that point because the differences in Europe are deeply rooted in very different moments in history and very different actors. Basically, in the UK, external funding of companies is driven by capital market institutions. Disloyal shareholding is the norm. If you invest in UK investments, then the UK investors will look, should be looking as agent, your agents, for the best investment, not to be loyal to the company they're investing in. So therefore, the practice is, at least, that payment of dividends at the end of the year should be the number one concern of company management. They have to be able to promise to their shareholders that there will be a good return on their use of their funds. Now, what happens if there's a downturn in the marketplace in a UK, US, Irish, Dutch type system? If there's a downturn and you have to keep your dividends up, then you're going to have to cut on labor costs, in other words, dismiss people. And this is the key fundamental difference between the UK system and the continental one. It's this one here. It's this line here. This one requires flexible labor markets to maximize itself, and this one actually maintains loyal workforces. These are fixed costs. These have to be flexible costs. Now, this is a fundamental difference in the EU. And this is the reason, this is the, one of the key factors at the heart of this rejection of the treaty. It's the fear in France, in Germany, that actually flexible markets and labor markets are going to win out, and that financial capital, if you like, will become predominant. Now, which is prevailing? I'm just going to show you very briefly here a long-term view of the world. I would argue that, of course, the UK-type system is prevailing. And the reason, one of the reasons for that is that from 1914 to 1991, I think we can say that the world lived in a parenthesis of permanent war. War in Europe, World War I, then a few years of semi-peace, followed by the slip into the Second World War, exiting into the Second World War, right through the Cold War, right through to 1991. One of the features of that long period was actually the suppression of capitalism and the control of capitalism by national governments. Another key feature of the time was the extension of state activities driven by social utopias, an overexpansionist view of what the government could do, I would argue. Let's look at some of the figures here. These figures here indicate the size of capital markets locally relative to GNP, to the national economy. And this is the size. This would be the national economy at one. Here we have France, which in 1913 was the largest capital market in Europe. It, French people invested, if they had surplus money, and they put it in Russian bonds, etc. France, Berlin, and London were co-equally large and central markets. Then came the war, and you can see, except for one very small bulge there, right through from about 1914, right through to 1990, the capital markets in France were completely under the control of the government. The way that French business ran was that French, big French businesses would be given bonds by the finance ministry to invest. They didn't have capital. Then things began to change. In 1990, France moved to free movement of capital for all sorts of complex reasons. From that moment on, control by the government of capital markets in France ended. And the capital markets in France became very large, much larger than the economy, and much larger than prior to 1914, when many people look back and say, before 1914, capitalism dominated. Now people in France say, ah, the capital markets are dominant. But actually, what is also goes alongside it is all this inherited of a very extensive social state that developed over 70 years. Now let's look at some of the other countries. There's Italy, which had a very small capital market and now has a larger one because it was a developing country at the time. That's the UK, where the size of the capital market is nearly twice or over twice the size of the economy. Everything in UK is quoted. The UK capital markets, London is the main financial center of Europe. That's where all the big German banks, the big French banks, the big Swiss banks are. They're in London. So the paradox is that London has re-established itself along with New York and Hong Kong as one of the three key pillars of the global financial system. Actually, I would argue London is the capital of global finance, because US is the New York is the capital of national finance, and very important globally for that reason. But UK is very internationally oriented. UK is the capital of the capital market for Europe, but not in the monetary union, for reasons I'll touch on. Now, these are the other countries here. This is the US, which has a large capital market, but mainly internally oriented. Germany, which has a rather small capital market here. There are only 600 companies quoted in Germany. Most of the German companies are family-owned, Mittelstand Firmen. And those companies are now being sold out because the new generation maybe don't want to be business people like their fathers. So they're selling out, going to Switzerland with $1 billion, and some of those Mittelstand companies are being sold off to Anglo-American firms who are splitting them up. And this is creating a lot of tension in Germany. And there is finally Sweden there, which is really owned by one family called Wallenberg. Sweden is owned by one family, Wallenberg. Wallenberg is the emperor of Sweden. Now, in all of these things here, you can see that the capital markets are much larger than prior to 1914. And indeed, actually, I'd go on and say that French business, has become much more Anglo-Saxon than French discourse could ever admit. And here I've got a chart which shows the growth in outward foreign direct investment going up here in terms of 1990 2003 as a percentage of foreign direct investment, and down here the growth in employment in persons within the French market. Up here you can see France is internationalizing at a fantastic rate. And if this rate continues, France is going to be very much in 10 years' time like the UK, just as internationalized, with very large corporations all over the world and widely dispersed shareholding. Germany, much less. UK seems not to have grown in this chart because actually it's already there. UK is the biggest foreign direct investment in Europe. But France, the paradox here is that France is actually becoming much more Anglo-Saxon than its public discourse allows it to be. And here is one of the key problems of the French non. The French cannot explain to their public what they are doing. And the reason for this is to do with their political culture. Here I just have some data which shows that actually the ownership pattern of the UK and France in terms of shares is very similar. There is a very widely dispersed shareholding in France. In Germany, it's very concentrated still. In other words, if I'm making a comparison between France and the UK, France is like the UK, and Germany is very unlike both. In other words, the cement underneath the Franco-German alliance is loosening, is not getting stronger, it's loosening. This is a picture of the German cross-shareholding nexus in 1996. Everybody owns everybody else, and everybody shares each other's boards. This is Germany AG. This is Deutschland AG. Germany incorporated. At the heart there is Allianz. Allianz and Münchenerie, both of which are insurance and reinsurance companies, which have their headquarters in the English Garden in Germany, in Munich. That's where I met my wife, so I know about that. I'm talking with authority on this issue. Here is the cross-shareholding structure of Germany 4 years later. As you will see, it's very thinned out. So even if Germany is behind France, it's going the same way. Deutsche Bank, Dresdner Bank, Westdeutsche Landesbank are pushing for Anglo-American type shareholder policy. And that raises the question, what's the problem for the European Union? And maybe I can stop here and we can ask questions and then I can show other slides if we need to. The deal between France and Germany was not one of love. It was one of great power rivalry. I've written a big and boring book on this, so I'll assert my position. If you wish to challenge it, please do, but I've actually done a lot of work for this, and I think the bottom line is that France so loved Germany, it said, hand over your Deutschmark. We don't want to be ruled by you, nor do the Dutch, nor do the Italians, nor do the Poles. And Kohl agreed. In other words, monetary union was a political decision. It was a political updating of the 1945 agreement, never to go to war again. It was an updating. And both political leaders said, essentially, this is much more important than getting the details right. The details have to be dealt with by the next generation. And it's the details where we've run into problem. Because if you create a single currency, what you're doing is actually creating the conditions for an Anglo-Saxon Europe, a free movement of labor, free movement of products, free financial markets, access to everybody else's markets, etc. A world of mutual recognition, in a sense. And now the problem is that we have 25 national stakeholder states. France is still La France, Germany is still Germany, Denmark is definitely Denmark. Nobody wants to be European, they want to be national first. But because there is no going back on the single currency, I would argue it is a peace treaty. It's not an economic convenience, it was signed as a peace treaty. So there's no going back on it. The question is, how do you get from here to there? And nobody knows. Option number one is Big Bang. Do a Big Bang. No way can Jacques Chirac or Monsieur Schroeder do a Big Bang, i.e. deregulate overnight. Maybe someone else can, but nobody has done it so far. So the second option is, let's pretend that nothing has happened. That's what Mr. Schroeder and Mr. Chirac have done. Let's pretend that actually Europe hasn't changed itself by having a single currency in a capital market, with its companies going global. They're bigger now than the US companies, by the way. let's pretend nothing's happened. So the third one is to try to reflate, to try to use the government to promote domestic demand, to leave the euro, that's what some people have been talking about in Italy, or to change the rules of the game, which is what some of the French and the Germans have done. And of course, the fourth one is, let's find an external enemy called the United States. Now, all of this has ended in an impasse. And this impasse is reflected in the famous cartoon of France swooning after the non. France is so confused, she doesn't know where to go from next. And that leaves me with one bed and 25 dreams. I'll just run you through these examples of what I think is the heart of Europe. and when you can then talk about what it means for the future. The EU Constitution, to give you an example of many different Europes, says the present Prime Minister of Spain is a milestone on the road to Europe becoming a great economic, military and economic superpower. Well, you can imagine how that would go over in the UK. Right? It's absolutely anathema. He's speaking to his own tradition. He's not speaking a European language. Here is Donald Rumsfeld, of course, who's speaking from outside Europe. I do not think Europe is Germany and France. That's the old Europe. If you look at the whole of Europe, its center of gravity has shifted eastwards. Donald, southern Italy is not the heart of Europe. This is a foolish statement by Donald Rumsfeld. It is just not true that the heart of Europe and the European economy is Eastern Europe. It is just not true. Jacques Chirac says, the countries who are lining up to join the European Union have lost a chance to keep quiet. This was also overheard by people in Eastern Europe who didn't appreciate Jacques Chirac lecturing them. This is Mr. Eichel, German finance minister, making a statement of fact. The stability pact was not conceived to be applied to Germany. Indeed, my predecessor, he would have said, thought it up in order to keep Italy out of the European Union, but what he failed to understand is that Italy invented accounting. They're very creative. In has come Italy. So, of course, Eichel is saying, yes, but I invented it for the Portuguese, I invented it for the Irish, for the Italians. It can't be applied to me. This is national thinking. Jan Brinkhorst, economics minister of Germany, rejection of the EU constitution, he said, mixing his metaphors, means that in the long run, the lights will go out and we will lock our country out of Europe. This is the sum total of good thinking, clear thinking, you know. And here is Claude Juncker of Luxembourg, who said, well, France and the Netherlands should rerun referendums to obtain the right answers if voters reject Europe's constitutional treaty. Well, Mr. Juncker must be living in cloud cuckoo land. If we resubmitted the European treaty to re-vote in France, it would be out by 90%. It would be a victory for Le Pen. And finally, the one statement which I want to say is the heart of Europe. It's an Irishman. Bertie Ahern, Prime Minister, says no one country has a monopoly on the European idea. Well done, Bertie. That's it. That's Europe. No one country has a monopoly on the European idea. Europe is a discussion platform between very different traditions, and it's that which has to be preserved. I'll just end up on this one, I think, by showing that this is indeed, I would argue, the key thing. Here we have, and I'm getting to the labour market side of it, here we have the participation rates of our population in our populations, national populations, in work. And here we have labour productivity. At Lisbon in 2000, the European states agreed that the definition of unemployment in the future would be 70% of their employable labour force in work. So that's what our objective is. A number of countries employ more than 70% of their employable labour force. For instance, Denmark has 76%. The Netherlands has about 74%. The UK has 73%. And the US, which I put in there as a measure, has 72.3%. Italy, on the other hand, has about 56%. Now, the unemployment figures of Italy, to take an example, are measured on those people who are recorded as looking for jobs. So if we say unemployment rate is 10% in Italy, we mean 56% of the employable population is employed. 10% of that 56 is then looking for jobs. Then we have to add the underemployed. In other words, all of this huge gap between Italy and the UK, which has the same population. In fact, Italy has about 30% unemployment rate. In fact, France there has, it's about 63, I can't see where is France here? France is here. France is the same size as the UK. It employs 6 million less than the UK. So its real unemployment rate is about 25%. That is the reason why the constitutional treaty failed. Employment. For 15 years, the leadership of Europe failed to deal with the key issue. In Germany, unemployment rates are higher than they have been since 1932. In France, they're 20-25%. And in 2002, Mr. Le Pen came in with 18% into number two position. 45% of the French electorate voted for extreme parties. This is the key issue, not the constitutional treaty. And that's why Blair's speech is so important, because Blair is really saying, I won't go on worrying about this, because this, I'm just going to show you a figure here, which is actually that the real champion of Europe is, in terms of productivity, is Ireland, with full employment. Blair, in his speech to the Parliament the other day, said, "It is time to wake up. We have received a major warning in Europe. We cannot go on in the world as it is and allow unemployment, in fact, to rise in the way that it's done." So the key point I think we should take from this is, one, there are many key points. One is that every country has to deal with its own labor markets. Nobody from Brussels has the legitimacy or the authority to put through reforms that will allow people to find jobs easily. It's local conditions that will prevail. And that means really that we have to rethink not a highly centralized Europe, but a decentralized open Europe. There is no way that Europe can close. No way. This is a complete dream. The Danes would never accept. Denmark, Holland, Latvia, Malta are completely open economies. They can't close behind tariff walls. This is a delusion. We have to be part of the global scene. We have to have local devolution of most major decisions locally. And we have to realize that Europe, as it's presently been constituted, has run into this problem. Complexity, my formula is, multiplied by ambition, I would add over-ambition, equals overburdening. Overburdening with expectations, overburdening with policies it can't deliver. The key to my mind is what we teach in business school. KISS, keep it simple and stupid, so that everybody can understand it. Keep it simple, close to people. There is no alternative. So to my mind, a liberal, open, decentralized Europe, what has to be rescued from this package, and that really puts Blair center stage. His challenge is to not win over the UK population, but to win over the populations of Europe, who are suffering from this very high unemployment, and from great fears that their own politicians, their own leaders, have failed. So I would argue we are at a real turning point in Europe.
Well, Thank you, Professor Storey. That was a very good presentation, and which raised quite a number of issues. And now I would like to give you the chance to comment or raise questions on what Professor Storey has just presented. Please.
Well, the paradox is that Blair, of course, is sitting on Europe and the UK, which for political reasons rejected deep integration into the existing structure because of fundamental belief, actually, that national institutions are what matter in terms of accountability. But also has, among the biggest big countries, the most presently prosperous, with lots of weaknesses, economy. The reality that Blair is speaking to, though, is a Europe, particularly in France and Germany, which has been humiliated by its own failures, and where national sensitivities are very, very close to the surface, and where, above all, people won't want to be lectured at by the UK. So this is going to be a very delicate operation. I would argue that Blair is absolutely right to stop talking in double language, which I think is the language of Chirac. Look how proud we're doing very well, when actually people individually are very worried about their future. I think Blair is absolutely right to say the people have spoken, the people are talking about real things. We, the European leadership, are far from getting close to what people's concerns are. That's going to have to, that message, I think, is going to have to lead to some very subtle diplomacy, the creation of a coalition of support, which would enable a coalition of like-minded groups across Europe and states to start fundamental reforms. And it has to go fast, actually, I would agree, I would think. It has to go very fast, because India, China, and countries like that are not going to wait for us. Countries in Eastern Europe are not going to wait for us. They now are introducing very simple flat tax systems of 18% tax for everybody. Fundamental reforms, because they are looking not at France and Germany, not even at the UK. They're looking at Ireland as the country which has most succeeded. And what has Ireland done? Ireland has educated its people very well and opened its door to foreign investors and has moved from the poorest within 30 years to the richest country in Europe. That is what Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania and the other countries of Europe are really looking at. They're looking at success, not failure. So the old countries of Europe are really going to have to move very fast. Right now, I'm concerned that unemployment rates can only rise in Germany and France. There's no way up. And in Italy in particular. Italy is wide open in its production sector to competition from China and from Eastern Europe, because its value added is rather modest. And those are particularly the sectors that the Chinese and the Europeans, Eastern Europeans, are moving into. So Blair has a great, very difficult task. The rest of Europe has little time. In my view, you're right. I think we're thinking exactly along the same lines. To my mind, I did my university in Ireland, and I'm thinking actually of writing a biography of Edmund Burke, who's one of the great philosophers, I think, political philosophers. He was the man who really, along with Locke, put his finger on the idea of consent. Consent is what matters. Consent matters in Europe, and it has to be local consent. This is a very, very important factor. And, of course, the other one is that we can't deny the reality of a global world. Quite the contrary, it's a great opportunity. Let me put it the other way around. consider that Europe has achieved an awful lot in 50 years. We've had peace, we've had development, and so on. But there are clearly signs which are very worrying. Decline in population relative to the rest of the world. Much lower patent issues. A decline in investment in sciences and research. Very high unemployment. The signs are very, very clear that Europe's not doing well. On the other hand, we shouldn't underestimate what we're capable of. I often tell people, ask people, who won the Olympic Games? The last Olympic Games. In 2004. And the answer is overwhelmingly Europe, not the Chinese or Americans. Europe had a sum of over 100 gold medals. America and China had 30 each. Europe is a magnificent mosaic. If I come in, I've been working a lot on China, I come in from China, where everything was ransacked over and destroyed over the last 100 years. All of the artworks and the historical buildings. I come back to Europe, I come into Copenhagen, it's a jewel. I could come into Valletta, it's a wonderful place. I could come to Palermo, I could go to London, I could go to Paris, I could go to Barcelona. There's nowhere else in the world where there's such magnificent signs of Europe's inherited wealth. All we have to do is to recognize that. I think very importantly, we have to think clearly about what Europe is and not what it should be. I'm obviously, from my talk, take a view that Europe is the second Europe. Europe is a legacy rather than Europe is capable of becoming a United States of Europe. I think that's going much too far. Not that I would object to it if people were supportive of it, but the French population are not, the German population are not, the Polish are very Polish. We have to make things close to people. And I don't think this is impossible. I think quite the contrary. We have an enormous opportunity now to make a Europe which is very effective in doing a few jobs very well. For instance, encouraging the movement of students among European universities. That couldn't be better. We should do much more in that. Or dealing with international crime. We should do that. Or cooperating on environmental questions. Or managing our common skies together. These are obvious tasks which have to be done together. But most of the key things which concern people day to day have to be dealt with locally. So I think we have to revisit our thinking about Europe. Thinking about Europe not as a unitary state, but as a 25, soon 27 states, a very different wealth, history and so on, who learn about each other in a permanent discussion platform and keep their natural ties to the rest of the world. I know this is something the United States doesn't like. The United States says, like Henry Kissinger, who do I speak to when I go to Europe? I want one voice. We can't speak with one voice, Mr. Kissinger. We have 15. Dealing with us is very complex. That's, to my mind, Europe's declaration of independence. I would agree that disagree fundamentally that we have to imitate the United States. I would like to point out on my chart there on productivity that Sweden is far more productive than the United States on per capita income. The Danes live a much better life. The Norwegians too. The Irish as well. We have examples of small countries which do very well. The big countries could do very well as well. The sum total of us would be Europe. We don't have to imitate the US. We just have to be what we are. And well.
Before we go on, I think I'll take a few questions because there is another activity to which Professor Story will have to be rushed to now. To the by the High Commissioner. So I'll take a group of questions. I've seen a gentleman here, and please keep them as short as possible. There's a gentleman there, Peter, and there is also the gentleman, and there is also Philip Linear. Just something which, and I'll put a question myself on the last. There are many I would have liked to put to Professor Story, but this one is I'm itching to put it. Would you then look at more at a confederal model of Europe rather than to the traditional federal model? Just a short question. And then we can go to the questions on that.
I don't think we can do anything else for the moment. I think this is the confederal model is what we can do with a very little bit of, even in policing, actually. Police love to be cooperative because they see international crime. But when they think of somebody else's police charging across their own territory after a criminal, they get a little bit scared about that. So I think a confederal Europe is much more like it, much closer to it, the reality. Well, I think this may be the agenda of Blair. He's always said he wants to put UK at the heart of Europe, and here is an opportunity. But he has to make Europe very much more acceptable to the UK. Problem number one is not the constitutional problem, which I think is there. problem number one is how do you get UK people now to vote to join the monetary union, if this should ever be put to the vote, when unemployment rates are so high. Now, the two issues are not the same issue, but in a vote, in a public vote, they would be. People would say, why should I join the monetary union? It seems to create unemployment, which is not true. It would be impossible, I argue, for the present government to sell monetary union to the EU with high unemployment rates. That's why the British government was behind the Lisbon agreements of 2000, to try to say, look, please make Europe more compatible with what we can sell to our population so we can actually join in the euro. In the euro. That was Blair's position, not Brown. So the attempt, I think, is for Blair to say, well, we really have to make Europe, for its own sake, much more friendly for its own citizens. We're very far from that, and so therefore I think we're very far from the UK either ever voting for the constitutional treaty or ever for the euro. The UK is not semi-detached now, it's almost a quarter detached. Well, it's a very important question. Let me go back in time a little bit. I followed it very, very closely because I wrote an awful lot on this in various journals and books and so on. So I followed it very closely. And when the negotiations on monetary union really began to pick up in late 1990, around about September, Helmut Schmidt, previous chancellor, wrote a very important article at the time in Die Zeit, which is a liberal magazine in Germany, saying the Bundesbank is trying to make it impossible to create a single currency by raising the demand so high that the French will never accept it. In any case, he went on to say, we should have a confederal currency. In other words, update the 1978, for those of us who know about this, the 1978 Bremen Agreement. And I went along with this because I think, personally, all the studies I've done, I wrote a book in 1986 where I used this phrase, a mosaic. It's a mosaic. And it's obvious that that mosaic creates very different conditions, and it would have been difficult to put them, those different countries, into a single currency. Nonetheless, the single currency went through for political reasons, not for economic reasons. And the reason for that was high politics. It had nothing to do with economics. Everybody who was against the single currency on bona fide grounds said there are going to be big tensions because you have different states following a single currency. If France and Germany, Italy and the other countries wanted to go ahead with a single currency because they were fearful of German unification and domination, then I can accept that, although I would argue that there was no reason to be frightened of Germany. Now they've got it, the implication is that you have to put through all of the conditions to make monetary union work, especially free labour markets. The UK put through free labour markets under Maggie Thatcher in the crucial years of 1983-87. The similar reforms were put through in different ways in the Netherlands and Denmark, etc., and in Finland, and under very difficult conditions in Sweden. They were not put through in the heart states of France and Germany. So all the predictions that were made by those who were skeptical about the single currency actually being applicable to different countries with different labor traditions is now beginning to manifest itself. So in my mind, it is a reasonable question to ask whether the single currency will hold. I'll tell you how I think it will hold for a long time. Not because there are not tensions in it, but because it was a political treaty. Nobody wants to go back on the political capital. It's not just that reputations would be lost, but actually a central compact between France and Germany would be undermined. And this would have very serious tensions and fallout. So everything will be done to try to rescue it. The only thing that has to be done to rescue it is to put through liberal labour market reforms. And there, French culture and German culture, as it's come to be formulated, is fundamentally opposed. I could not get anybody in France to say, what are the conditions for full employment? And get them to answer, well, frankly, to introduce a legal system whereby managers and owners have the right to hire labor and fire labor. This is something that the French population would never accept. But they also don't accept unemployment. So how do you move, if you refuse to get to the means of it, how do you achieve full employment? That's the debate. And it's a fundamental one about values. Unfortunately, I think the French and the Germans are heading down some very serious path, which implies increasing tensions with inside the European Union on money. The heart of this is the phenomenal increase in productivity, for those of us who know on the economic side of it, in Germany, as the German companies are going international and accelerating. Germany has now overtaken the United States and Japan a long time ago as number one exporter. Italian productivity has stayed very low. So the gap between Germany and Italy is growing. That can only mean increasing tensions within the single currency. The single central bank has no political authority to deal with the key issues, which is labor market questions, tax, and those are matters for national governments. The national governments, particularly Germany and France, don't know how to speak to their populations and explain that the implications of the policy they accepted to put a monetary union means that you have to go in a liberal way. They don't know how to do it. They're stuck. I wrote an article in 1993 saying that the limits of integration is public consent, and I don't think any governments have gone beyond that. They haven't understood how to deal with public opinion.
I think we've run out of time. I have to stop the lecture here. It's been a very interesting, I would say, all good things must come to an end. And at some point, and Professor Story's lecture has, in my opinion, raised quite a number of has disturb the hornet's nest, as it were. It raises quite a number of issues for discussion. And this is what we brought him over to do. It leaves me nothing more but to thank him for the presentation, for coming all the way from Paris and from Berlin before that, the rush through the airport to come here and begin the lecture. Thank you also, all of you, for coming here and waiting patiently for this lecture and for your participation. We much appreciate that you came and stuck with us. And thank you also those who had questions, and my apologies to those who had to leave because of this slight change of time. And also my apologies to those who had to put questions but could not put them this evening because we have to cut it short. Thank you very much. We'll close here.
Thank you. Thank you very much.